welcome to Martian Driving Podcast 136. My name is Terry Frost, and this time I'm doing a few things. I'm going to talk a little bit about the death of Harlan Ellison, and I'm going to be talking about Luke Cage Series 2, the second season of the Marvel Extended Universe series that Netflix have dropped about a week ago. So I'll get the contact details out of the way and I'll start letting you know why I've been away for a month. Martian Driving Podcast is a two-weekly podcast about science fiction, fantasy, and other genres, cinema and television. From George Méliès to the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the DC Extended Universe, anything's up for grabs in this podcast. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. And if you want to give feedback, you can go to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com and leave a voicemail or an email message. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, adult concepts and words may turn up. So if you're going to be listening to them with kids around, put on the headphones. Or if you can't do that, you're going to have a lot of explaining to do. Okay, so how has everybody been? I apologize for being away for a month, but real world stuff kind of interfered with it. My sister up in Sydney, Linda, and my brother-in-law, Gavin, and my nephew, Billy, were going to Hawaii for a week, which indeed they did. But we needed a family member to be up in Sydney so they could be close to my mother, who's in a nursing home with dementia. I've mentioned that before on the podcast. So Sal and I drove up to Sydney and house sat for a week and a bit. In Maroubra, kind of trolled around Sydney, did some things, caught up with at least one person, and just kind of looked after both Mum and Gavin's mother, Faye, who's also quite old, but not in as bad a condition as Mum is. So that kind of came up a little bit suddenly, and before that, of course, we had the weekend of Continuum, the local science fiction convention, so we packed a lot into about 2 or 3 weeks there. It got very busy, and so unfortunately I didn't have the resources to put out the podcast. So again, I apologize, but that does happen. But I'll let you know what happened. First off, Continuum, the Melbourne Regional Science Fiction Convention, went over really well. It's a crazily inclusive convention. They do things like have a little space on the front of the convention badges so you can put your preferred pronouns, whether you identify as male, female, or other. You can put that in there. They've got a really, really good policy on harassment and other issues like that. They're very green. They didn't provide lanyards. You provide your own lanyards because that was, again, a way that they can kind of save the world one lanyard at a time. And they've got a very diverse range of people who go on panels there and a diverse range of panels. There was a lot of stuff about gender and a lot of stuff about inclusion and things like that in the science fiction context, which I'm really on for. Had a great time. Sal went there with her crafts and did very well selling all sorts of craftware at the convention in the dealer's room. And I got to be on two panels. Now, they were both kind of fun. And unusually, they were really well, not unusually, but the audiences responded to them very, very well. The first one we did was we were kind of thinking that there are a lot of American superheroes out there. So we, on the spot, we created a whole bunch of Australian superheroes with distinctly Australian powers. Wish I had have recorded it because it got really friggin' crazy in there. It was one of the late night panels, so everybody was not necessarily liquored up, but good to go. And there was me, there was the delightful Jane Routley on there. Liz was on there, a lady called Liz and a guy called Bismuth. And we just kind of played with the ideas, and the audience and us had a really great time. We did a whole bunch of transgressive stuff with superheroes. I created a few superheroes myself. I did one called Single Mum, which is a superhero who can do anything 10 men can do. And we kind of played along with it and along those lines. And we had a Hulk kind of creature called White Rage, who was a conservative white man who turned into a Hulk-like monster whenever a feminist disagreed with him. So we kind of played with those ideas and played with superheroes in a social context. Had a great time. Second panel was a lot of fun. There were four of us, me, Rob Hood, who's been on the podcast before, and a couple of other people, where we talked about Universal Movie Monsters from the classic era, Universal Movie Monsters, and had a great time with that. We talked about going to the cinema and seeing the monsters, and just kind of played with it for an hour. It went over really well with the audience. The room was actually a little small for the audience, which is always a nice thing when you're on a convention panel and you suddenly realize they should have given you a bigger room, but you can't plan these things ahead of time. But yeah, it was, both panels went over really well. We had a great time there. And then after the convention finished, and for those of you who have been to any kind of convention know that while you're there for 4 days in a row, it's a very intense time. You're cramming so much stuff into a short period of time that it does kind of enervate you a bit. So we had 2 days at home after that, and then we drove up to Sydney. It's about a 900-kilometre drive. You can figure that out in miles if you're a miles kind of person. We stopped halfway at a place called Holbrook, which is really weird. It's an old town that used to be called Germantown, but during the First World War, people thought that it was a bad name for a town, and so they named it Holbrook. And they named it after some guy who was very, very big and did some heroic things on a submarine. So Holbrook, which is about 150, 200 kilometres from the ocean, actually has a submarine, the HMAS Otway, which they moved wholesale to the town and assembled in a park. So this country town inland has a submarine as a tourist attraction. So we kind of dawdled our way for the first half of the trip, stopping in country towns, looking at bookshops and having a great time of it. We got there, crashed out early because it was pretty cold and damp. It's winter down here. And left at a ridiculous time in the morning so that we could spend a little time with the family before we had to take them to the airport so they could fly to Hawaii. So we did that, and then Sal and I saw Mum a few times. She was in a better condition than the last time I saw her, which is great. She's healing from the injuries of her fall, but the dementia, of course, is still there and isn't going to have a positive result. But we did hang out with her, and I've written about that a bit on Facebook. We looked around a bunch of bookshops. I picked up some movies, as is my wont, at that wonderful place called Hum in Newtown. We kind of cruised around the harbour a little bit. We ate Chinese food in Chinatown, did all the things that we like to do in Sydney. Then the family came back a week later, and we spent a few days hanging out with them before we drove back to Melbourne. So it's been pretty full on over the last month, running around, doing interesting things and having a great time, and of course spending too much money. The other thing that happened, and I'll just give you this, is I've got I mentioned before that I got the 55-inch TV from Kogan, which is an online retailer here in Australia. And it started going wonky just before we left for the holiday, where it would work for an hour and then the screen would go dark. So when I got back, I contacted Kogan. They gave me a way to do a firmware update on the TV, because TVs these days are just computers with enormous monitors. Did that, didn't help the situation. So now I've got packaged up in the other room a 55-inch TV, which is going into the repair shop so they can evaluate it. Now, under Australian consumer law, I can get my money back. I've had it for about 10 months, but it's just not working. The 4K they said it had doesn't really have 4K natively, so there's a little bit of a kind of grey area there. So I'm going to get my money back. Under consumer law, I can get my money back. So that left us with the problem of not having a TV in the main TV room. So knowing that we were going to get the TV back from, well, the money back from the TV from Kogan, we went out and bought another one. It's more expensive. It's just as big, 55-inch. It's got YouTube and Netflix natively on the TV. There are, in fact, buttons for it on the front. And we're quite 2 days in, we're quite happy with that. One of the reasons we got it was that Kogan, in order to have the TV put in for evaluation, requires us to put it into a television box. And there aren't that many 55-inch TV boxes lying around here. We didn't keep the one from when we got the thing, which was fairly flimsy anyway. And I caught up a couple of places who do boxes for people moving house. And the best price I could get on an externally sourced box was $160 for a padded box to put a TV in. So Sal and I talked it over and we bit the bullet and bought a new TV, and it works marvellously well. And we put the old one into the box. We kind of trimmed down the foam padding so the old TV fitted in, and that's going back to the repair place that Kogan uses, and ultimately I'm going to get a refund. So, yeah, it was traumatic for me. The weird thing is, suddenly you're without a TV, and I do a lot of stuff through the TV. Not only watch TV, but watch YouTube. It's my main media thing at the moment. And it was quite traumatic having it malfunction in an odd way. Yeah, it's a first world problem. I totally agree with and acknowledge that. But it was really kind of, you know, it pissed me off because I'd paid out good money and this thing didn't work. And I was pretty miffed and quite upset by it. But we've fixed that problem. And tomorrow, oddly enough, they're picking it up on a Sunday, which is odd. They're going to pick up the TV and take it down to the shop. And I don't think it's a minor problem. If the TV picture is dropping out after a period of time, there's something going wrong there. And as I said, under consumer law, I'm going to get my money back. So all of that stuff's been happening. So what I'm going to do now is take a break. And when I get back, I'm going to talk about the death of science fiction and fantasy writer Harlan Ellison. I've written something on Facebook about that, which I'm going to quote here. And just talk about some weird things about it that have been worrying me.
Do you like great music? Do you like in-depth podcasts? Do you like the idea of putting great music under the microscope? If you answered yes, no, or fish to any of these questions, Love That Album is the show for you. Every month, Morris and a fellow music fanatic discuss a particular album in detail. They'll cover the performer, the history behind the recording, the musicianship, common thematic elements between the songs, and how many drugs were consumed during its creation. Well, maybe not so much of the last bit. So, if you want to hear a podcast bringing perspective to great rock, jazz, folk, punk, and sea shanty music, then subscribe to Love That Album Podcast at Apple Podcasts, or download directly from lovethatalbum.blogspot.com.
Okay, so let's move on to the death of Harlan Ellison. I met him several times, one time at SCINCON, the Sydney Science Fiction Convention, in 1983. And a couple of subsequent occasions as well. He was larger than life, charismatic. He was a lot of fun when he was on stage, but he did have his darker side. And so I wrote something 7 hours ago for Facebook, which I'm kind of going to quote you to let you know that my conflicted feelings about Harlan Ellison. So here it is. The death of Harlan Ellison has really brought me to the sharp edge of one of our modern dilemmas, that dichotomy between an artist we admire and the personal flaws that made them damage other people. Ellison humiliated another writer, Connie Willis, a bunch of years ago in public. You can find the video if you want the details. Connie was supernaturally gracious about it, which doesn't excuse the act. A friend reminded me that a woman at SCINCON 83 accused him publicly of groping her, and her assertion was dismissed. That those were different times doesn't mitigate the inaction of the committee or Ellison's denial about it. But I also learned that Harlan paid for Octavia Butler to go to the Clarion Writers' Workshop, which kick-started her career. Mind blown. He also marched in Selma, Alabama with Martin Luther King Jr. in 1965 and wrote about it. Nobody is just one thing. I deeply admire his work, The Glass Teat and The Other Glass Teat, in which he eviscerated the banality of 1960s US television, and Harlan Ellison's Watching, which opened my eyes to what a shallow and derivative work Star Wars was. I treasure all the stories he wrote that are iconic to our genre. His anthologies, Dangerous Visions and Again Dangerous Visions, were juggernauts of the new wave of science fiction that broke the genre out of the strictures imposed by the thematic hegemony of people like John W. Campbell. He gave us Demon with a Glass Hand and Soldier in The Outer Limits, The City on the Edge of Forever in Star Trek, the old original series, and Shatterday in the 1980s Outer Limits. To admire his work, I also have to acknowledge and condemn the things he did that were beyond acceptable behaviour, and that duality vexes me. Social media encourages me to be polar on the issues, to throw the gold out with the grit when I'm panning in the river of our zeitgeist. It ain't simple. Weinstein was a monster, but he produced superb movies even as he raped and ruined the careers of women. Spacey, who I've met, is an actor of rare talent. Michael Jackson's music is important to many people, even though he groomed and molested children. Some people say we're damaged by knowing too much about the people whose work we admire, but I don't buy that. You and I aren't children. We don't need to be protected from the knowledge of the evil that men do. We need to unflinchingly accept the truth. We need to defend, nurture, and support those who have been wronged. And even when it sticks in our throats, we also have to face with honesty the inevitable fact that some of the men who inspire us were pricks. There's a reason why they keep making movies about Henry Jekyll and Edward Hyde. We just need to stop accepting his potion as an excuse. That's all I've got to say on the matter, really. It's a complex subject. So I'm going to take another break, and I'm going to play the trailer for the season 2 of Luke Cage on Netflix. And then we're going to talk about it, and it's a really interesting series, and it ends on a note that's really, really interesting. So from here on, there may be spoilers.
Yo, I'm Luke Cage. You want to test me? You know where to find me.
Ooh, got it all, man.
Everybody talking about Luke Cage like he's Jesus.
I ain't no joke. I used to let the mic smoke.
The bulletproof black man. For the hard rocks, he's a ghetto boogeyman of their nightmares.
You can get a smack with this.
Really, guys?
You gotta know we tried, man.
I ain't no joke.
But one man cannot save a community.
You can't keep doing what you're doing.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
And believe me, Luke Cage is nothing but a man.
Alim is mine.
Damn!
Hate to see such a positive brother like Luke Cage go down like that.
He hurts you. You're not invulnerable, Luke.
Anyone who can take you on barehanded can't be good for Harlem. I gotta find him.
Bushmaster, what makes him so scary?
We hope you never have to find out.
You tell Bushmaster that I'm coming.
It's game time. Do what you want. We stay feeling fools. Do what you want. Your life for your choices.
I've seen you raw, but never brutal.
Sometimes brutality gets shit done.
Harlem doesn't need a hero. It needs a queen.
The darkness that you deal with every day, it can consume you whole. If you let it. Don't let it.
Just so we're clear, I'm not in the market for a sidekick.
Who says you're not my sidekick?
Me? It's my show.
Okay, so at the end of the first season of Luke Cage, he's got his powers back and he's actually stronger than he was in the first one. He's more bulletproof, he's stronger, he's faster, and he is the hero of Harlem, played by Mike Coulter, of course, in the Netflix series of that name. He's in a relationship with Claire Temple, who is a nurse and who seems to have dropped into specializing in the medical problems of superpowered human beings in the streets of New York. Of course, she's played by Rosario Dawson in a way that has a tremendous strength to it. It's a female kind of strength. It's not an aggressive strength. It's a strength coming from self-knowledge. It's a strength coming from a very female place. And I found that really interesting in this context. Now, this is part of the Marvel Extended Universe, but it's street level. It deals mostly with various kinds of crime rather than the larger scale stuff that the MCU movies do. And that's kind of cool, getting that granularity of the zooming in to the streets of the Marvel Universe is interesting. It's not the spook stuff you get with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It's not the high-level Universal stuff you get with the MCU. It's right down there on the footpath next to the gutter. Even though there are rich people in the series, it's not a rich person's world. And one of the interesting people in this world is Mariah Dillard, played by Afri Woodard, who runs Harlem's Paradise, the best and coolest nightclub in Harlem. Her family's run it for three generations. Her grandmother started out as a brothel keeper and they kind of built the family business up from there. And Mariah has a legacy of a lot of things. The criminality of her family, which she's trying to expunge by getting rid of all of the illegal businesses that she runs and becoming a legitimate business person through a inside trading deal with a plastics company. But she can't let go of her past. She's a victim of sexual violence in her past, which we get a lot more detail about that during the series. And she is basically a vicious psychopath. Her right-hand man is Shades, played by Theo Rossi, who's also her lover, and they have a really interesting relationship. She's older, of course, than he is, and yet they are devoted to each other, and the advice he gives her is valid. He tells her that she's got to let go of the past. She should sell him Harlem's Paradise so she's free of the criminality that's almost seeped into the walls of the building. He tells her that she can finance these a share deal she wants to do by selling a Basquiat painting that she has on the wall. And she'll end up making something like $230 million from the deal. The painting's worth $2 million. So he gives her the best advice he has possible. But the flaw in Mariah's character is that even though she's running away from the criminality of her past and the murders she's committed and the acts of violence that were committed on her, around her and by her, she is ultimately a self-defeating character, and that's really, really interesting. We also get to meet the daughter of Mariah, Tilda, who is a doctor and who has kind of given that up in order to become a herbalist and finding, she's almost an alchemist. She's incredibly complexly knowledgeable about natural remedies. And in the MCU, that's not too far away from magic. And she's played really interestingly by Gabrielle Dennis. And she too has an arc. Mariah wants her to run a clinic that she's opening to help single mothers in Harlem. And that having her daughter, the doctor, be a part of that will legitimize the business and really help her become a legitimate business person in Harlem rather than the child of a crime family that she's perceived as by a lot of people. Problem is that Mariah gave up Tilda for adoption, even though she kept contact with her. And so they've got a very complex and problematic relationship. And Tilda doesn't quite know for most of the second season the extent to which her mother will go in order to get where she wants to be and to do the things she wants to do. So you've got that happening there. But there's a new player in town as well, a villain who appeared in the Luke Cage comics, but is very, very different in the series than he was in the comics, as indeed are most of the characters. And he is John Bushmaster McIver, played by Mustafa Shakir. He's a Jamaican man who, through, let's say, herbalism, has a lot of the same powers as Luke Cage. He's almost bulletproof. He's very strong. He's very fast. And he has a grudge against Mariah Dillard's family. Like Killmonger in Black Panther, he has a point, but he's going about it in the most violent way possible. And he's a striking guy. Mustafa Shakur is a scary-looking guy. He has pale eyes and very strong features and a very thick Jamaican patois. Now, the Jamaican patois is problematic. I've just finished reading an article by Jamaican Americans saying that the portrayal of the Jamaican community in New York, and in particular the use of patois as a kind of, you know, dialect of English, is really, really ropey. It's a kind of, I can empathise in a lot of ways, because we get the same problem when people who aren't Australian try to do Australian accents. They get it wrong and it always sounds really bad to our ears. There are also cultural problems with it, and there's kind of a little bit of a quote-unquote magic Negro trope about the way that the Jamaicans are portrayed in the series. So there are some people of Jamaican-American descent that have some problems with it. A few other people have said that it's not a problem particularly, and that it has given some minor roles to Jamaican-American actors. And you know, I can see both points in that, but I just thought I'd mention that. So Bushmaster is going after Mariah. He knows a lot of stuff about her because they've got somebody on the inside. There's always somebody on the inside. And he goes after her financially. He goes after her psychologically. And to clear the decks a bit, he king hits Luke Cage and knocks him cold. He studies him and studies his fighting moves and does a capoeira kind of fighting style that just lays Luke Cage out flat. Now, again, that's another problematic part with the Jamaican thing. One of the things Jamaican Americans have said about this is that you're more likely to see a boxing gym in Kingston than you are a capoeira studio, because capoeira is Brazilian. Yeah, it's from further south than the United States of America, but it's nothing like the actual fighting that goes on in Jamaica. But I suppose capoeira kind of works better than boxing does, visually at least. So that's probably the reason that they did it. There are 13 episodes in the series, and the usual complaint comes up that there's not enough plot to cover 13 episodes of a Marvel Netflix series. It happens with every Marvel Netflix series that there's not enough story to cover the episodes. But I kind of disagree with that. I think that what the binge 13-episode arc kind of format does is it gives the storytellers room to let the characters breathe more than they would in a more tight format. We learn a lot about Shades and Mariah's relationship. We learn a lot about Mariah and Tilda's relationship. We also see an arc in Luke Cage's relationship with Claire, where he starts drinking his own Kool-Aid and he lets his anger inform his actions. So there's a kind of theme of toxic masculinity in this particular series, and the character of Luke Cage teeters on the edge of that. And here's where the spoilers start, I suppose. That destroys his relationship with Claire, because she had a violent family past and she's not buying into it. So she goes and visits family in Cuba and is off the scene for the rest of the series, except for one very, very important mention right at the end of the 13th episode. So Claire writes him a reality check, which he never cashes. Maybe he does a little bit, but her absence is the thing that makes him cash it rather than her presence, which is kind of interesting. And he ends up being mentored in some ways by a bunch of different men, one of whom is the guy who runs the barbershop, where Luke Cage's kind of headquarters is, where his friend DW is also running a T-shirt business to try to give him some money. And that guy is Bobby Fish, played by Ron Cephas Jones, who basically is there as a surrogate father figure for Luke Cage to a certain extent. Then his real father, Reverend James Lucas, comes along, played by Reg E. Cathy, in his last role before, unfortunately, he died of lung cancer. And his father's a preacher. Luke isn't particularly religious, and they had a falling out when Luke was in jail, wrongly convicted of drug charges, and Reverend Lucas blamed his son for his mother, for Luke Cage's mother's cancer, and basically said some really nasty things as while he was going through his own pain. So there's a big gap there which slowly heals over the arc of the series. He's another person who kind of mentors Luke Cage through the series. And the other one's slightly unusual in the sense that Finn Jones comes back as Danny Rand, a.k.a. Iron Fist. And there's a nice little kind of breathing space episode towards the back end of the 13 episodes where we get a little bit of Power Man and Iron Fist happening there. But also there's some very important information conveyed verbally and also through action by Danny Rand to Luke Cage, where he tells him that money, having money, is a superpower. And he demonstrates that to him. And that then informs and leads to where the situation as it is at the end of the series. So a lot of people have kind of dismissed the Danny Rand episode. There's a lot of bad taste in a lot of people's minds about the Iron Fist series, which wasn't successful for a number of reasons. But I believe that Iron Fist in this particular season of Luke Cage performs an important function to get the character where Luke Cage needs to be to complete the story at the end of this season. And more than the superhero series, this series is about relationships and about crime and about the legacy of toxic family relationships. And there are a lot of family relationships in this one. And there are some interesting relationships of other kinds as well. There's a really interesting dynamic, which I'm going to let unfold for yourself. I'm not going to do a spoiler on this one. Between Shades, Theo Rossi is fantastic in this, by the way, and his number two, Comanche, played by Thomas Q. Jones. They were in jail together. They were there beating up on Carl Lucas, a.k.a. Luke Cage, before he got his powers in Seagate Prison. They were tight. They were friends from childhood. Shades knows Comanche's mother very well and almost like a second son to her during the series. And there's an arc between those two characters, which is a bold move by the makers of the series, but it's a really important one, and it just kind of gives that an extra level of complexity to the character and to Shade's relationship with Mariah Dillard, which really does take the narrative to a different level. We also get another comeback character, Simone Missick as Misty Knight, the police officer who loses her arm in the first series of Luke Cage, protecting other people. And at the start of the, there's a good arc for Misty as well. At the start of the series, she's dealing with the fact that she's lost her arm. She's on light duties as a police officer. And there's a lot of shit that she wears from other cops because of who she is and the fact that she helped take down her previous partner, Scarf, played by Frank Whaley. He does a little bit of a return in this series in one episode. And so she's got to kind of stay true to herself, work out what she wants in her life, and kind of deal with the sudden infirmity and the sudden being a person with a disability that she has to deal with during the series. And she has a really interesting arc there. Inevitably, as we know from the comics, she does get a bionic arm, thanks to not to Stark Industries or anything like that, but thanks to Danny Rand's company, which makes prosthetics, one of his many, many companies, because he's a billionaire, makes prosthetics, and she is given and learns to use basically a robot arm, which helps her kick ass. There's also a nice episode which kind of parallels the Luke Cage Iron Fist episode, where Misty Knight teams up with Colleen Wing from Iron Fist, and they kick some serious ass in a bar. So that was good to see. There's Nightwing Investigations in the comics, by the way, is Misty Knight and Colleen Wing setting up their own detective agency. Doesn't happen in this series of Luke Cage, but we get a little bit of a flavour of those two women who can kick ass and don't even bother to take names, really kind of getting together. I would watch Misty Knight, Colleen Wing TV series. It would be a lot of fun in the Marvel street-level universe that we have here. In fact, I'd watch a Power Man Iron Fist series with Luke Cage and Danny Rand together as well, but then I'm a kind of welded-on Marvel fan, and I read all the comics, so I'd like to see where that would go. There are so many paths opening up for this particular corner of the Marvel Universe that are very exciting and are very, very, very different than anything we're getting in the MCU, including Black Panther. And as the series progresses, we get to a moral dilemma that Luke Cage has. How does he keep crime out of Harlem? How does he keep Harlem, Harlem? And how does he keep it as a community of people of color and a multicultural community and keep crime out of it? And to do that, he has to take on a new role in that community. And that kind of happens in an interesting way in the last episode, where Luke Cage, and I'm not going to do spoilers beyond saying this, becomes the sheriff of Harlem, in a sense. He becomes the protector of all of Harlem by certain actions that he takes. And he becomes a very different kind of figure in the community than the bulletproof man with a hoodie walking the streets and going into bodegas to stop people fighting. He has to step up into a new level of the community in order to do what he wants to do and to be the person he thinks he wants to be. Now, there are going to be problems with this, and that's foreshadowed a lot in the last episode. But we see a very, very different Luke Cage at the end of season two of this series. And we see the perils of where he is and how he lives, which make it really fascinating. I am dying to see a season three of this series. I think it will be kick-ass, and it will talk to a whole bunch of different societal problems than we got in the first two seasons of Luke Cage. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the music. There is some fantastic music. In fact, the music is almost at a better level than the first one. The first one really kicked ass. Adrian Young and Ali Shaheed Muhammad composed the score, but there are also, because part of the movie is set in a nightclub, some really good music, which I'm going to investigate these artists further because I really enjoyed the music. We get Joy, we get D-Nice, we get Donald Harrison, Gary Clark Jr., DJ Mr. C, Esperanza Spalding, Christone Kingfish Ingram, who does a fantastic version of I Put a Spell on You, the old Screaming Jay Hawkins number. We get Ghostface Killah coming in there, Stephen Marley, Faith Evans and Jada Kiss. KRS-One does a fantastic job. And right at the end of the series, we get Rakim doing something that becomes almost a leitmotif for Luke Cage, where he is at the end of the series. I'm going to play Rakim's track for you as well. That one's called King's Paradise, which is kind of interesting. And the name itself kind of hints at some things. But just to kind of wrap up Luke Cage Season 2, I think it's strong. I think that I'm fine with the amount of plot there is for a 13-episode series arc. I've got no issue with that at all. I think Mike Coulter lives the role a lot better than he did in the first one. There were moments when he kind of didn't quite nail it in the first season, but he definitely does it in the second one. Alfre Woodard as Mariah Dillard is one of the great monsters of acting. Her character is so complex and nuanced and unpredictable and tragic and monstrous and ugly, everything combined. I really do like Mustafa Shakir as Bushmaster. I think that he really nails it, even though apparently his Jamaican patois wasn't that good. One of the problems you have with a series like this is actors don't often get a lot of time to get accents right and to get now that stuff down. But from my kind of ignorant viewpoint, I really like it. Reggie Cathy is fantastic as Reverend Lucas. As Ron Cephas Jones as Bobby Fish is great. Thomas Q. Jones as Comanche. I've already mentioned Theo Rossi as Shades Alvarez. Simone Missick's great in there. Jessica Henwick in a little bit she does is good. There are just so many complex characters in here. And they don't shy away from the ugliness of life for poor people at all in this series. They don't address life in Trump's America very much, though ICE is seen as an enormous threat to the Jamaican-American community and the fact that people can be taken off the streets even if they are American citizens and held in detention is mentioned. And there is another mention of Trump in there as well, which is kind of chilling but interesting. But I think it really does work. For me, it worked really well. I binged a lot of it in a day. Mind you, I haven't been watching much media apart from that because I've been out and about doing things while I was in Sydney. But nonetheless, I think it works. I really do like the second season. I like the fact that there's some fantastic writing and acting in there, and the music just weaves it all together in an incredibly tight matrix. So I'm going to leave you with Rakim's King's Paradise because I really like it, and I think it kind of thematically gives you a bit of a taste for the series. By the way, let me know if you like me doing these recaps of the Marvel Netflix series. Drop me something on Facebook or send me an email or even put it on the Patreon website or else the Podbean website. I'm happy to have a chat about it with you. So then I'm going to leave it about there at the moment with Rakim's King's Paradise. I'm going to redo the credits for the podcast as well. That's something that's been on my list for way, way too long. And it's kind of nice to get back into it after almost a month of not doing it. I was kind of hesitant at the start of it, but I really do. I did miss doing the podcast, to be honest with you. And I was getting the itch to do the podcast. So I'm going to be knocking out a Paleo Cinema very soon. And then I'm going to get back to the weekly schedule. And then another Martian Drive-In podcast in 2 weeks' time. So in the meantime, look after yourself. And I will see you all very soon. Now, here is Rakim with King's Paradise.
Welcome to Harlem, the home of innovating. Legacies, stories of gods killing Satan. Where they honor Harlem's father, Philip Payton. The Renaissance in the making. Ellington, Garvey, Joe Louis, Lena Horne, Malcolm, Maya, Louis Armstrong. But now crime is the new crave. So it's a new crusade. So salute the Luke Cage. Fight for the cause. All the way to the top. Rivalry wars. Life could be lost. No type of remorse. Forward always for pop. Until the crown is rightfully yours. But success brings sacrifice. And no one was at stake, the pressure could crack a fight. Where everything has a price, but you pay with your life in the king's paradise. The king, king, the king, king, the king, the king, the king's new cage. The king. Story is complicated. He got framed for a crime and incarcerated. Locked up, his alter ego builds. Experimented on left with superhero skills. Now every day he gets twice as strong. Bulletproof skin, but his life is torn. The only lady he ever loved and his life is gone. Escape prison, gotta fight, the right is wrong. No question, he gon' take on the whole hood in a hoodie. No weapons and no cape on. One by one and knock him out. Until Cottonmouth is forgot about. But success brings sacrifice. And if you're thinking it's a piece of cake, you can have a slice. It's like gambling with a paradise. But you pay with your life in the king's paradise. The king, the king, the king. The king, 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 the king,
Okay, here are the credits, and I've got to kind of give a shout out to our good friend David Kummer, who is roasting in Minneapolis at the moment and has supported the podcast as well. I will incorporate you into the credits very, very soon, David. And here are the credits. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Drive-In Podcast, done in the style of film credits. I'd like to thank Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our Foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, the second unit director, Paul, the special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our script doctor, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Eric, the set security lead, Richard H., the set photographer, Mark D., the extra, David L., the extra, and Richard C., our transport co-captain, plus Andrew, our necessary film critic. We have Kerry H., our accountant, and Kerry L., our other spiritual advisor. Thank you so much to all the patrons for dipping into their pockets and helping out with the podcast. This has been a Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In production. The end.